You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Hello, people. It's good to see you. Welcome back, or welcome for the first time, to the Hope and Anchor, where we are all about having conversations that go deeper into the spiritual journey, wherever we are on the spiritual spectrum, joining in together. And we are, as I said last night, and if you're new, if you weren't here last night, we are recording a podcast. So Hope and Anchor is not just a venue here at Greenbelt and across the land at different festivals, but it's a podcast of folks who listen into conversations going deep into spirituality across the country and across the world. So as I did last night, I always sort of warm up the room for a podcast so it doesn't just sound like a BBC Radio 4 interview. That's not the vibe we're going for today. We're going for like intimate church, intimate spiritual community, and so shout out youth group, kind of a car boot sale all together. How's that sound? So I need applause after this, if that's all right, for the podcast audio. I'm Trey Hall for Open Hearts and Open Minds. This is Hope and Anchor, recorded live at Greenbelt Festival. I did that last night. It does not get old. All right. How many, something that you've seen today or yesterday that's like a favorite thing so far? Just shout it out. Elephant Session. What's that? Generation Feral. God. Mud. I think you said God. No, not God. Queer and Hymns. It was beautiful, beautiful, wonderful. And then as we're a spiritually seeking place, people who are religious, not religious, spiritual but not religious, atheist, agnostic, fill in the blank, don't know, trying to figure it out, we love to think about and talk about how we experience and encounter God in different ways. And so I'm just going to invite you to shout out, as you warm this room up, your name for the higher power or God or the source of all being. What is your name or a name that you use for that something that you believe in or trying to believe in or trust in? So for me, it's like I said last night, the love that will not let me go is one of my favorite names for it. What about you guys? Loving parent God? People are like, God. I use the name God. Elroy? Amen. All right. Anybody else? Cosmic chill out bloke. All right. Let's keep diving in. Friends, just to say, because it's a podcast, if you yell something out, the mics won't pick up stuff very much in the back, but if I repeat it, you may get on the podcast. So just know that the mics are not sensitive enough to pick you up on the tables if you're having conversations. So don't worry about that. But big brother or big sister is not listening in to you. Lovely. Well, with no further ado, I am so thrilled. Let me flip my pagers here to introduce our secret special guest tonight. If you're a writer, it must be praise indeed to be compared to George Orwell. And our guest's work on understanding the so-called underclass in Britain has seen him compared to that commentator. In fact, Irvine Welsh calls his writing an intellectual and spiritual rehab manual for the progressive left. With a musical alter ego putting out a similar message in Scottish accented rap, it could mean we're getting two guests for the price of one. Darren McGarvey, welcome to Hope and Anchor.
Thank you. Hello, everyone.
It's so great to have you with us.
It's lovely to be here.
Is this the first time you've been to Greenbelt?
It is, yes.
Yeah. What's a memory or an image you're going to take away? Because you're just here for the day, right?
Oh, it's just the feeling that people are here for more than the complete moral nihilism that a festival usually offers. Which obviously I'm not judging, and I've dabbled in some of that myself. But there is just a feeling, there's a nice temperament about the place. Normally I'm in a rush to get in and out, but I've hung about here for quite a while today, and that's really just because it feels nice and warm and welcoming.
Yeah. Folks were, I went to one of your earlier chats today, you've been in a couple places, and folks were really packed in the rain to listen to you at the living room, so that must feel pretty good.
Yes, it does, and it was interesting as well, because at first I thought, well, they're all just here because it's raining. So then I actually had to verify why they were there by asking them.
Yeah.
And so I was like, how many of you have read what this event is actually about? And then a lot of hands went up. So it was, it's always nice. It's always nice when there's interest in the message that you're trying to carry.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, if there's no one to carry the message to, then that can be a little bit demoralizing.
Yeah. So you are, many of you will know Darren's work and his writing, his speaking, his essays, his music. You are a prophet of the working class. Some have called you that. You are someone who is about calling for change and working for change, systemic change in society. In my experience, lots of folks doing that work, there is an earnestness about that work. There is a uber importance about it, which is good, but sometimes there seems to be a dryness about it. Mm-hmm. And you, in the midst of doing that work, are calling for the centrality of the arts. Mm. And I'm just, which I love, that there's a place for joy and laughter in the midst of social change. Why is that important for you?
Oh, it's so important because a message has to have a certain kind of weight and depth to it. So there's the intellectual aspect of understanding a problem.
Mm.
And understanding what a solution might look like. But there, a culture has to develop around that. And part of a culture is artistic expression, whatever that might look like. And I know from my own experience, there is no shortage of artists or intellectuals or thinkers or poetry from working class communities. But often people from middle class backgrounds, they confuse the differences in how things are expressed from those lower orders because they're so used to hearing it being spoken in one voice with one temperament from one vantage point. That's the middle class vantage point.
Mm.
And when it comes from a working class perspective, it often comprises different issues that are expressed in different ways. So my passion will be interpreted sometimes as aggression. Or the language that I choose to use, which to me seems pretty common, will be seen as vulgar or threatening in some way. And so we have the double trouble of not only trying to create a culture around our particular struggle and articulating our particular vision, but we also have to be mindful of how we can nominate ourselves for exclusion just by being authentic. So it's quite a high wire act for someone like me, who has now penetrated kind of mainstream culture in the UK to a certain extent, because I'm always having to think, how does this thing I'm trying to communicate here translate to over here? And even right now, I'm doing that.
Yeah, does it feel like code switching?
Well, yes, but I don't see the negative connotation that comes with that. Some of us, we have to do that. And I code switched a lot in the working class community. The way that I would talk with some of the younger men was different from the way that I would talk to a teacher. Yeah. It's different from the way that I would speak to my father.
Yeah.
So that's all just kind of built into our social software. Yeah. It's just a bit more galling sometimes for working class people when they see one of their own apparently adopting some of the mannerisms and speech styles of the enemy. But for me, then I feel it's essential that some of us are able to operate fluently in any environment, and I'm as easy to communicate with a high status, successful, powerful person as I am with someone who is doing life in prison.
Let's take it back to the arts. And something that, can you give an example of, you were talking about comedy that, or arts that might feel vulgar to the middle class. Can you give an example of what you mean by that? Because we can all imagine what that might be, but something that really you think is brilliant, is artistic, is stunning, is hilarious, but might not work.
Yeah, I mean, just rap music in general.
Yeah.
Rap music is hip-hop culture is the biggest selling genre outside of classical music globally and has been for about 20 years. And for a lot of kids from deprived backgrounds, one of the things they're being deprived of is a decent education. And so for many of them, their first literary experience will be with this apparently vulgar, violent, misogynistic art form. Now, obviously, the commercial iterations are always more vulgar and violent and misogynistic and sexual because that's the economic imperative of capitalism.
It's what sells.
Underneath it, yeah. Yes. But outside of the commercial, there are underground cultures, and in there you will find practitioners of all of these disciplines being very innovative, very sophisticated, but it gets lost because people are so conditioned to not hearing it that when they do hear it, it sounds weird to them. Mm. So if I was to rap right now in a Scottish accent, the first thing that you would feel is a kind of discomfort. You would feel a discomfort. It's just like someone like you is not supposed to do this, when actually I'm the prime example of a person who's supposed to do that.
Yeah.
And the problem lies with the person who finds it uncomfortable. They've got to do a little more work. They've got to open their minds a little wider. Mm. And it can be challenging because you always feel like you're having to do more than just the work of creating. You're also having to make it safe for people to experience it. Yeah. And luckily for me, because of some of the prestige that comes with being recognized as a writer or television presenter or whatever, it means I can smuggle some of my stuff in.
Yeah.
And because I've been kind of rubber stamped by Radio 4, some level of sophistication is assumed.
That is where I first heard you. I just moved to this country and I heard an interview about your book.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Exactly. So it's like I'm aware of the class dynamics and the quantum mechanics of class, which means that I can navigate the terrain a little more elegantly than maybe someone who hasn't risen many rungs in the social ladder.
When did you know that you were an artist?
I grew up in an artistic household. My father is a songwriter. My family, we've got a kind of Celtic vibe, our family. You know, at a certain point, if the family gets together, the guitars will come out. Everyone can do a turn, a little sing-song.
Yeah, yeah.
There were always, my godfather, my uncle, he went to art school. So we always punched above our weight in terms of cultural interests and politics. So I never had that challenge or that problem that a lot of people from working class communities have when they recognize they have creative impulses. Mm. I didn't have that battle of, should I be doing this when everyone else is playing football? Mm. It was in me and I never had that struggle. I was always encouraged. It was just that the opportunities weren't there. Yeah. I was interested in acting. There were no opportunities. I was interested in other musical instruments. You would get jumped walking around my community with a brass instrument. It was like a foreign object. It was like, I got mugged for a trumpet I was carrying home from school, and the people who stole it, they didn't know what it was. They didn't even take the mouthpiece. They just ran over the hill with the trumpet, you know, like chimps discovering flame for the first time. And, so it was just kind of futile. Whereas hip hop and rap, it gave me an outlet to be creative and be involved in a creative practice while still kind of draped in the veil of toughness and masculinity. And that's actually the secret sweet spot a lot of young men find, where actually they're poets. They just have to pretend they're gangsters.
Yeah.
Because being a poet's not cool in a poor community sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. You wrote someplace, you wrote about comedy being something that working class folks is like a commonplace. And why do you think that is?
Well, one of the ways that we discharge trauma or we discharge adversity is to find the levity in it. That's one of the ways that we make light of difficult situations. And even if you look at very successful middle class comedians, often, you know, someone like Jimmy Carr has been very, very successful.
Yeah.
Every one of his jokes, what he's trying to draw out, whether you agree with the humor or the target of the joke in that age-old debate, he's always talking about something that's pretty horrendous.
Yeah.
He's always trying to make a comedic chestnut out of something that's pretty dark.
Yeah.
And so what a comedian offers us is a one person's perspective on the world. And also what the comedian does is something that you don't see in a lot of other disciplines, where they have to go on stage by themselves and be accountable for everything that they say and stand behind everything that they say. And so people that are coming from a working class background, which a lot of the best comedians do, and that's just a fact around globally. Mm. One of the things that they, when they have that crossover appeal is because not only are they funny, but people who are laughing at the jokes, they're laughing because they're learning something new okay. about a walk of life they don't know a lot about. So when Dave Chappelle is joking about a baby selling crack on the corner, he's making a social comment about poverty and deprivation. But for a lot of people who find that funny, it's just the image of a baby drug dealer. That's funny. But underneath that is something much more serious. And so the laughter comes often when we learn something new and there's a light bulb and then we laugh to discharge.
That's really interesting because I feel like I laugh a lot at things that are really horrendous but that I identify with.
Yeah.
So someone's on stage talking about like huge pratfalls that are actually moral failings that are actually like edging off into the pit of despair. And I'm like, you know, because I've been there, but it's not a, that's different from what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, there's all people have a different way into comedy. Some people, some comedians, I guess they're more kind of surface level. It's set up punchline,
yeah.
Michael McIntyre. I remember him being described by Stuart Lee, as spoon feeding people has warm diarrhea. That's how he described Michael McIntyre's comedy. And you can see why that's funny, because Michael McIntyre has a specific type of comedy, which is not making a comment on anything. It's basically saying, here are some things I noticed about how people behave. But we find that funny because it makes a safe space for us to laugh at ourselves. So there is still some kind of utility in that comedy.
Sure.
But it's definitely not like deep, profound, making an artistic statement. But I think comedy generally is something that we take for granted. And we don't realize the artistic merit that a lot of comedy has. Mm. We have an entitlement to laugh. And so some comedians are successful because they have a joke every 30 seconds. Mm. But some of the best ones, they can take you on a 10-minute journey.
Yeah.
And there's no laughter. And they're playing with tension and expectation. And then the laugh comes, but it's not even a punchline. It's some other revelation that's a bit more meaningful. It's like looking at a beautiful painting or listening to a beautiful piece of music.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of revelation... this is a show, this is a podcast, this is a space where we're looking for the spirituality running through everything. And one of the questions we always like to ask our guests on the stage or in the studio, around the table, is how people identify as spiritual or not.
Yeah.
And I'm just curious, how do you identify as a spiritual person? And if so, how would you describe that spirituality?
well, within myself, there is a spiritual dimension to my life, which has been widening really since I was looking for answers to deal with my alcoholism. I remember a faith-based organization that I was working with many years ago when I was still in my addiction.
Mm.
And we were doing some activism around poverty. And I remember Paul Chapman, he passed away over the last year. He was a mentor of mine. And he was a great wake-up call to some of the old ignorant stereotypes you can fall upon when you think about the church and when you think about faith. He was an older man, but there was a youthful exuberance about him. And I remember one day he says, are you a person of faith? And I says, "What do I have a choice?
Hmm.
And he found that really funny. He laughed, funnily enough, but I wasn't meaning to crack a joke. I was coming from a perspective of I didn't have much. I didn't know where my life was going. I was in permanent crisis. And so for me to just get up every morning and go about my day was an act of faith.
Yeah.
And for me, faith differs from belief. Belief is when you have practiced faith and so you've acquired certainty about the nature of how spirituality operates within your life, whether that's a particular religion, whether that's a particular lifestyle. Faith is when you make a commitment to a certain course of action, but you don't know what the outcome will be, but you practice the faith nonetheless. It's when you, despite your doubt and skepticism, decide because there's some evidence in your midst, maybe perhaps how it's worked for other people or the good that it's that's been done in your community, you say, do you know what? I'm going to try this.
Mm.
I'm going to try this even if I don't get instant results. I'm going to go on a journey of being open-minded and humble that maybe these people, who to me at some point didn't seem that cool because they were talking about God and spirituality, might have answers to the problems that are defining my existence. And for me, I've always oscillated between the faith and the belief, which is directly relative to how hard you practice the spirituality. Because when I'm plugged into the mains, then my material wealth doesn't matter to me. Yeah. The level of fame I enjoy doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is being on the other end of a phone for someone else. What matters to me is that my children feel safe and secure. Yeah. What matters to me is spending time with the people that I love. But, you know, the ego can come in and reality and truths. And then it's about reassessing and plugging back into the mains.
I love that image of plugging into the mains, like that plugging into the current or the water that's not you, but is offered to run through you and sort you out.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's one of the things about it is in Scotland, we have a phrase, it's felt, not telt, which means you feel it. You don't tell people about it. You feel it. And with recovery, in the particular program of recovery that I follow, it works for me because it addresses all of the fundamental areas where I experience problems in life. So it begins with acceptance of the magnitude of the problem that I face. I'm screwed. I know I'm screwed. Step two, I need help, but the help can't come from me.
Yeah.
Step three, every day I need to behave like someone who needs help. Then you examine the root causes of some of your issues. You clean up the wreckage. And then you integrate those principles into your daily life. And then you use that to go and help other people. To me, that seems like a pretty good spiritual diet.
Ooh, it feels, I mean, that's a 12-step diet, right? Which is one that I follow. But I hear that just the way you say it. I'm like, sounds like the transformation offered in, I would say, in the church. Or at least in Christianity, or in other major religions, like this sense of like, that's just the steps of how you plug into the mains, that just transformation.
Exactly. And I remember a really great therapist when I was in rehab in 2019. There was just so many little gems he dropped, and I was luckily in a receptive place. There are some people out there, whether it's your minister, whether it's some guru you follow, a friend, they have a way of distilling what could be really complicated truths into a little sentence that you just absorb immediately. And one of the things that he said was, the mind can't be in two places at once. When you're thinking about someone else, you aren't thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
And I find that my trouble in life, no matter how my material circumstances, the level of dysfunction, whatever it is, at the core, the suffering comes from over-contemplation of all of that. Speculation, having expectations that it should or could be different. And my problem in life comes from not being able to bring clearer faculties to bear to the problems that I have because I'm absorbed in this ongoing dialogue with myself, trying to fix a problem from the confines of a sick mind. And so the 12 steps for me, which I think follows a pattern that you see in all proper spiritual teachings, and really is, it's borrowed from all the best bits of everything. It really is just a kind of a diet to follow where you get a bit of freedom from that chattering head.
Does anyone else in the room identify with the chattering head? Just curious. You don't have to be an alcoholic. I'm just curious, that chattering head, right? Like my sponsor in AA says, in addition to being an alcoholic, Trey, you have a thought addiction.
Yeah.
And by that he means like I am addicted to my misaligned, messed up, effed up thinking, which is that kind of incessant chatter. And I don't think you have to be an alcoholic to have that diagnosis.
No, and I always try to emphasize this in the recovery work that I do with others. There is a kind of reading of recovery which says we are distinct entities in every way. We think differently, we behave differently, we have different needs. We are almost like a kind of separate class of person.
Special people.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a kind of pitfall, isn't it? So then when you're sort of that terminal uniqueness that we are afflicted by from time to time. Actually, what differs me from other people is just that when I put alcohol into my system, I lose the ability to regulate how much I take after it. And I also have a mind that has identified alcohol as the solution to almost any problem. So I have an obsessive mind that's fixated on alcohol, and I have a body that cannot process ethanol properly. And when those two things are firing at the same time, I'm in a lot of trouble. And for me, that's what differs me from non-alcoholics. But I try to say that to people who perhaps are coming in the door early. Don't worry, that head that you've got and those problems that you've got, these are human problems.
Yeah.
The difference is most people, they can go home and either have a glass to forget or have a glass in order to get perspective. They can use alcohol as a tool.
Yeah.
They can reconnect with people. They can experience a sense of calm or relaxation or become really engrossed in something because alcohol works for them.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work for me.
My partner is not an alcoholic and drinks normally, and he'll have like a glass of wine and drink half of it at dinner, and like he'll enjoy it and he'll feel like a little tiny kind of frisson, and then he won't drink the other half. And I'm like, are you gonna leave that on the table? Yeah. And he's like, I've had enough. I was like, what does that feel like?
Yeah.
I mean, I never had enough.
Yeah, it's when people say I have to stop now because I'm starting to feel it.
Yeah, I'm like,
when I say I do not understand, I mean it. I don't understand how you could drink alcohol and then stop.
Yeah.
Like after a half a glass, it doesn't make sense. I have never picked up the drink thinking I'm just going to have one. But the time I'm ready to take alcohol into my system, I'm drinking to oblivion. I'm drinking until there are blue lights flashing and I'm in the back of a police car or an ambulance.
Yeah.
That's what happens every time I pick up a drink.
Yeah.
With whatever intention I had in my mind. So for me, it's as lethal as a peanut as to someone with a peanut allergy.
Yeah. Let's go back to this. Like, so those of you who are like, oh, I don't have a problem with alcohol. By the way, this is a dry bar because we're the Methodist Church and we also want to be in solidarity with those who are in recovery or thinking about recovery. If you have a question about recovery, you think you might have an addiction problem or an alcohol problem, come and find me at some point over this weekend if you want to talk. There's also AA meetings every night or 12-step meetings every night at 8 o'clock, and you can find out more information at the bar, actually, ironically. So, but this whole thing around like people who aren't traditional addicts, you said in step one, we have to admit which is the magnitude of an unconquerable problem by ourselves, right?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, I'll speak for my own tradition in the church, sometimes I feel like people have never really contended with the problem that they have because it's not dressed in the same dramatic terms as it is for you or for me or for other folks. They're like, well, I'm fine. You know, what do you say to someone who's like, I'm fine? I mean, I want to say you're not fine.
Yeah. But there is a part of me that does want to point out how they're not fine. And
yes.
Then it depends on their proximity to you. Right. So if you have a friendship that's suffering as a result of someone else's alcohol dependency, then you are obligated by the bounds of friendship to raise that in a way that might be uncomfortable. Sometimes we will avoid those conversations because we want to preserve the sense of attachment that we have to someone, or we don't want to upset them, or we don't want to experience the discomfort of changing the parameters of the relationship by being frank. But I know that's what began a journey for me of coming to a place of understanding. However, there are also places and situations and contexts where we should feel okay to remove ourselves from a problematic drinker or addict who has not yet reached a point where that window of lucidity is opened and they have a bit more insight into the true scale of the problem that they have. Because we know from our experience, when we're really lost in addiction, we are deeply, deeply selfish, deeply dishonest, deeply fearful, and deeply resentful. And there's just no communicating with someone when they're firing on all four cylinders like that.
Yeah.
But life has a way of bringing us to a state of reasonableness as long as we don't die in the process.
Yeah.
But that's the risk we take.
Yeah.
If we relapse and we don't get on top of it soon, then that's what can be someone's rock bottom. For me, I've been lucky that I was always plugged into a community of some description, and I always had reliable friends with insight around as well as the drinkers. Yeah. So I was never far from being stumbling into the light of the truth at some point.
Yeah.
And that always was enough to get me to that state of reasonableness where I was like, right, okay, I need to take action.
Yeah. I'm going to invite a couple questions here in a second. So be ready to ask them if you have them, but I'm going to ask you one other question around this whole thing. I feel like the people who are spiritually searching, because of people's experience of trauma, because of experience of religious trauma, where they've been told certain things that have harmed them, there is this whole spectrum of where you find wisdom. And one of the things for me as a control freak, a recovering control freak, but a control freak all the same, and people who know me in this room will be like, amen, is that I needed something outside of me to save me. I needed something that was not me. I could not listen to my own wisdom, particularly in alcoholism. There are other folks who would say, and these are people that I love and believe are on a spiritual journey, would say like, I needed to actually tap into the inner wisdom that was in my gut and was inside of me. And I wonder how you think about inside, outside, deep gut, God outside of your disordered thinking.
Well, different faiths have a different conceptualization of where that sanity comes from. Mm. But one thing they all have in common is that the human condition is the struggle for sanity. And by sanity, I don't mean you're either being committed to a mental institution or you know everything about everything. We can be going about our lives on a day-to-day basis and is what might be as useful as a dream state.
Mm.
We're able to fulfill our basic functions, but we spend most of our time in our head thinking about past situations, conversations, thinking about what's going to happen later on. We don't realize we spend our whole lives like that. Mm. Nothing gets solved through that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's only taking action that solves things, and to take the right course of action, we require a level of clarity, aka sanity. Now, obviously, you might have the kind of Buddhist conception of it, where it kind of dwells within us, and what gets on top of it or what blocks it out is the pursuit of desire, momentary, fleeting relief, gratification through behaviors, through altercations, whatever it might be. Or you have the kind of more Christian concept or the Muslim concept where there is an instruction that has been given, that has been dispensed, that we can follow. And by committing to certain disciplines and living our life by certain principles, then our antenna will be better attuned to that voice that's coming from heaven or wherever it comes from. So for me, I feel it bodily.
You do.
My body tells me when I'm plugged in because the level of anxiety dissipates. I see myself and my problems in some kind of proper perspective.
Mm.
And also I have an urge to listen to others, to be of service to others.
Mm.
And it can be simple things like I'm at home and then I just have an epiphany where I'm like, oh, that head, it's been going for an hour. And then I have this surge to get up and do something nice, like clean up the house or spend a bit of extra time with my kids that's not necessarily just the baseline skeleton service of parenting or something nice with my wife. You know, things like this, they matter. Or shooting someone a little message or someone that I'm working with, phone them, how are you?
Yeah.
Letting them know that I can hear them. And when I do those things, then I experience reassurance from the body.
Yeah.
This is the way to live a life. And then as quick as that, you're back in self.
Yeah.
You're distracted by a beautiful person. You're distracted by an advert.
Mm.
The instincts are all firing again. And for me, I'm never going to be that levitating, godly person who's just plugged into the mains all the time. Not many people are. I'm always going to be moved by pain.
Do you want to be that person?
Hell no. No. I have my vices and I like them too much. You know, I'm the person who's sitting going through the program and I'm like, no, I'm keeping some of these character defects. I need these to deal with my enemies. So it's just a balance, isn't it? But I think
that
through maturity, I recognize that for me personally, I'm always moved from thought and over contemplation into action by just sitting in my own misery and going, I just don't like how this feels, and actually knowing how to get out of it.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Masterclass. Questions from the congregation. Anybody? I see, is that someone back here on the, I can't see who it is. You and, yes. Just want to shout it out. Could you give a little bit of a rehearse
repeat,
the question?
So yeah, we're getting the classic first in my working class family to go to university, and now I feel like a bit of an alien no matter which cultural class sphere I'm in. And this is very, very common. It's very common, and it's one of the negative impacts that you can experience as a result of being one of the few to enjoy a certain level of social mobility. Social mobility is kind of sold as the ultimate form of propulsion through society. You start here and then you end up here. But no one really talks about the process of insecurity, the process of overthinking interactions that you're having. How do you talk? How do you present? I experience it in almost every industry that I've had any kind of success in. That's why I'm more comfortable in the hip hop scene, because I can just kind of relax, because there's a familiarity there. If I bump into a hip hop artist at a festival like this, it's like one of my people, you know. It's just dead easy to talk to. The way around it, it's really to just accept that that's your circumstances. You'll feel a lot of pressure, and I do it because I'm a political activist as well. I mean, no one is harsher on me than the radical left.
You know?
I mean, even just going on Radio 4 for some people means that I'm complicit in every single crime of the British state.
Yeah.
For some people working, a documentary series being commissioned by the BBC means I'm best friends with Jimmy Savile himself.
Yeah.
You know, and I can understand why that antenna's up and understand why that skepticism's there. But at the end of the day, these are things I want to do with my life. These are things that I think are important. I've thought deeply about why I want to do those things and trying to find where the integrity is within those transactions. I don't apologize to anyone for where I'm in life, where I want to go in life, because I know within myself why I'm doing things. Even when I'm doing things for material gain, that's a reasonable motive to have, to make a decision, to get some security for your children.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say sorry for that. And often people who are the most critical, it comes from a place of envy. It comes from a place of, I wanted to do those things, but I didn't have the opportunities, or I was too worried about what people thought. So I kept myself to myself, didn't push myself further, and then I created a fake story to retrofit that lack of potential for, so that they can live with the fact that they never made the sort of moves that you made. So just get wise to people's bullshit, man. You know, be who you are. Stand behind who you are. Don't be completely resistant to criticism. But people are pulling you up for being articulate and calling you posh, they're brain dead. Who cares what they think?
Other questions? It's a great first one. Is there another one back here on the same duvet, at the same sofa?
Do you want to repeat the question?
Yes, the question was around different kinds of addiction, and I think it was Sally was talking about, she has a work addiction, and that's judged differently because of people compare that to someone who's perhaps working class, who has a sort of stereotypical drug addiction. And how can we get to, she says, how can we get to a place where neither of those is stigmatized? Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what I was hearing. I think that a particular status is conferred on a behavior as a result of the social class of the person engaging in the behavior. So an example I like to use is, you know, you have a king. He's the highest status person in the land. He eats so much that he gets fat. And in order to deal with being fat, he unbuttons the bottom button of his blazer. And all the courtiers see this and they think, that's how you now should wear a blazer. They don't think why they think that. They just say, this is what people of our social status do. That's an example of a behavior which a status is conferred upon as a result of the social class dynamic. And it's the same when it comes to culture. So when I was talking about rap music earlier, people have a prejudice against rap music because it was originated in African-American communities in the United States during a crack epidemic.
Yeah.
Even cocaine. If you snorted cocaine, you were seen as a high-flying city boy.
Oh, sure.
And if you injected cocaine, or smoke crack cocaine, then that is scummy and that is seen as lower class. So when it comes to addiction, you can see the same dynamics. Although a work addiction sounds great, I quite like abstaining from that. How did you recover from your work addiction? Oh, I just don't work at all, man. I'm allergic to work. As soon as I start working, I just get out of control, so I can't do it. I quite fancy that, actually.
You can talk to Sally afterwards.
Yeah.
It's interesting about the crack cocaine and the cocaine, like the criminal penalties are different as well. So just around, it's not just around, I mean, that's the class.
Well, when the laws are written by the people who snort it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like,
other question. Another question. Yeah. Right here.
That's just the person asking a question who works in the drug sector in Scotland, where there is the worst per capita drug crisis in Europe, and second only to the United States. And we have the world's worst cocaine problem also. So our drug death figures, the composition of the mortality rates are changing year to year, as is the patterns of drug use, the availability of drugs. But the one consistent factor is the absolute failure of government to get a handle on the problem, because there's been an over-reliance on one particular form of treatment, which is known as harm reduction, which works very, very well in a context where there are other options available, such as abstinence-based recovery. And then people get to find what works for them. It's like a diet. A particular diet's not going to work for everyone.
Yeah.
So we have a lot of different health programs, and people, they shop around and then they go, well, maybe I could do that type of intermittent fasting, that suits me because blah, 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 or I'll do this. Recovery's a bit like that, but where there's no choice, then you see people being directed towards a particular thing, which is usually opiate replacement therapy. But opiate replacement therapy, the efficacy of a drug like methadone only really improves in the presence of psychosocial support, i.e. community. So when someone's just on methadone in isolation, it's only a matter of time before they start using other drugs on top of it. That's why methadone shows up in more than half of all death certificates since it's been prescribed 30 years ago. In terms of how can you bring yourself to this problem, it's very, very difficult, but especially when people are in the sector where the harm reduction is prevalent, because all they see is the despair and the failure. They don't get to see the people who come in the door and get well really quickly because they're supported by other people who've found a solution to the problem. But I guess it's always about, one, reminding yourself why you're doing it, reminding yourself why you're there, and reminding yourself that while a person who's in severe addiction presents socially in a very extreme way, which marks them out as distinct from everyone else, that person was once a normal person like you, a morally normal person, an emotionally normal person. And I bet you 9 times out of 10, the drug they're addicted to was given to them by someone who loved them, who just wanted to help them feel better for one night. And that set off a chain reaction that led them to a service that sometimes has as much chance of killing them than the drug. Sorry, I know that's not the cheeriest answer ever. But, I mean, I'm on the front line up there, so I know the script.
I mean, related to that, and it's not cheery, but I heard your talk this afternoon. I read some of you've got a new kind of project around trauma and trauma-informed reality, and how your whole thing is, as I understand it, you know, that the whole thing around storytelling and personal narrative and testimony, which can be a very beautiful thing, if someone is fighting against marginalization, fighting against poverty, fighting against some sort of systemic force that keeps them down, that oversharing can be actually can do more harm than good. Yeah. Am I getting that basic in a nutshell?
If I could break it down in our kind of religious context, people in here who have any kind of prayer life, you know, the quality of the answer that you get back is relative to the question you ask. It's relative to the prayer. So if you pray for a big car, you're not going to get much back, because the higher power's a bit busy with sincere requests for guidance. When we tell our story based on a misunderstanding of what our true motives are, or even a misunderstanding of what the truth of our story is and its meaning. And we do that in an exhibitionist way, thinking we're going to get some sort of catharsis. In this culture, in this time, you're going to suffer. You're going to suffer because there are certain prior conditions that have to be met before we are really fit to put our personal business out there. And that's not just about making sure we're okay. There are certain stories which kind of jigsaw disclose the information of people close to us, family members. Mm. But we've got this idea, well, this is my truth. Mm. Which is quite a narcissistic way to look at it, because it's not just your truth. It's your interpretation of your circumstances. Mm. And I bet if you've got trauma or adversity, that's relational, which means other people are connected to it. And not all of them are perpetrators of harm. So sometimes in this rush to get the catharsis or the fleeting admiration or the sense that we are contributing positively and upcycling adversity into something meaningful, we forget what we might lose in that process. Yeah. Because there is a kind of sanctity and an integrity about keeping some things back that are private. And we need guidance about what's an appropriate level of disclosure, what's an appropriate context to share in. But because we live in an age of big tech platforms where we are the product and our experiences are the commodity, there's really tremendous incentives for people to overshare and then become the public face of a particular issue when, you know, they might not even have that much insight into the issue, but the story they tell is really compelling. They're really charismatic. And unfortunately, that can end in tears for a lot of people. So my book that I'm working on in this campaign that I'm in is really trying to create space within that discussion, which I welcome, to say there are other things we need to talk about here other than just mining adversity for a nice narrative to draw people towards a certain political issue.
So this is, I think this is so important, and also it seems really fraught to me, like, because for me, let's talk about it personally. I think within a place of protection, within a place of, like, for example, a church small group or my recovery group, to be able to mine my shit and put it out there in a safe and trusted environment has been salvation for me. Yeah. Where, like, if I bottle that shit up, that's death dealing for me. Yeah. But so you're talking about something different than within a place, a community of safety, a community of trust.
Yeah.
You're talking about this kind of,
if we share in a meeting, the meeting is governed by certain principles and expectations about discretion. Mm. That's why all the fellowships have the word anonymous after whatever it is that they're about. Because there's an understanding that without the proper context of what's being discussed in there, our problems might scandalize us outside of that environment.
Yeah.
So that understanding is ingrained in the whole culture around the 12 steps. And any kind of mental health group or any mutual aid organization, whatever it looks like, it will, any process where there is any sharing or disclosure around personal adversities and details, it will already be baked into that process that people are safe to share because the conversation is closed and limited to the people who are present. Mm. But with the what I call in my book catharsis culture, that's different. We're being invited to take part in people's documentaries or news stories. I seen a woman interviewed by Vice talking about how she ended up getting into sex work.
Yeah.
And then talking about her traumatic background as a victim of various forms of abuse. And the way that she was talking about it was so frank, you could tell she trusted the journalist. You could tell the journalist done what all journalists do, which is make someone feel very safe and comfortable.
Mm.
But she had no control over how that's then presented subsequently. And I bet when she watched it back, the first thing she felt was, I said too much.
Mm.
So it's about saying, storytelling is part of our culture, it's part of our nature, and that's how we navigate our reality. The Bible's full of stories, the Quran's full of stories. There are stories that we just use to illustrate in our minds just to navigate our relationships. But it's a profound and powerful thing, and there has to be safeguarding and a duty of care wherever someone is being asked to disclose publicly to people they don't know things that they will never be able to undisclose.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it can end in tears, particularly for people who are told a catharsis will come.
Yeah.
When actually telling the story and not knowing why you're telling it or not knowing how true it is, that can complicate everything for them.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned today in your talk, baby reindeer. And I watched it, and I watched it, and let me just confess, like, I was drawn to consume it. And I also felt, as I was watching it, something is wrong, like, something felt wrong about it. Like, both the, I don't know the guy or the woman, but, like, not only did it feel wrong, I felt like I was wrong by watching it. And is this the kind of thing that you mean?
Yeah, and I said in the earlier event, if that was an action film, there would have been a stunt coordinator making sure the actors were safe whenever there was any kind of fight scenes or anyone handling firearms. Mm. There would have been an intimacy coordinator if there were any like sex scenes. But all that's required for a person with trauma of abuse to get a three-part Netflix document drama done is just them saying, I'm up for it. Yeah. Of course they're up for it. Yeah. I mean, look at the carrot that's being dangled there. Yeah. This is a guy whose last throw of the dice after a career that was going nowhere was to vomit up the most traumatic stuff that had ever happened to him. Mm. And while I don't think he would reverse the decision and go back and do the fundamental thing differently, and it's his story, and I don't judge anyone for using their story in any way that they want, and he's an artist, but there should have been some other stuff in place at Netflix to say, do we have to say this is a true story?
Mm.
Does that undermine the drama? Is that not what makes it pornographic?
Mm.
Would this stand on its own if it wasn't framed as this is true? Not even based on truth.
Yeah.
This is true. Because once you say that, that's when the court proceedings start. Because then truth becomes a whole other concept. It's not your truth. It's the truth.
Yeah, yeah. What makes something pornographic?
I think it's when you become desensitized to the cost that's being paid by the person who's made the thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you are titillated or drawn to something where you become fully immersed in the illusion that's been presented and completely disassociated with the mechanics that go on with creating the thing. That for me, and you talked about it there, yeah, you had a sense that it's the sort of sense that you get if you invade someone's privacy because you're suspicious. You know you're doing something wrong, but you justify it to yourself. But this is even more different. This is purely for your own pleasure. You're doing this. And I only watched the first episode and I couldn't watch any more of it. Because to me, and I said this at the Pagoda, it was as shocking to me as some forms of pornography would be to people in here.
Thank you for talking about that. And what are the conditions that make vulnerable? Because I think about, we talk in this space around mining the deep story, mining the deep caverns of us, and that is, I think, sometimes, well, if it's safe, it's where we can discover God in a new way, discover our true selves, whatever metaphor you want to use. What do you feel like are the conditions, let's pull back from Baby Reindeer, in healthy, vibrant human society where that truth-telling can happen?
It's relational. So if we're lucky enough to be born into a family system where that is already an established way of being, then we're very fortunate. And we're fortunate in a way that we don't even recognize because it's already something that we just expect. That's why when we come across other people's family structures, they can be quite galling. Just the little differences in how conflict is aired out. The little differences in how you express your feelings or the ways that you dance around things or confront things. Often, most people, they have a family structure and then they have a found family, where it's like a primary support network and a secondary support network. So in recovery, that's my primary support. I don't go to my family with the most urgent problem I'm experiencing in my inner world. Because just by dint of culture and genetics, they're probably in the exact same problem themselves. I go to them if I just want to have a moan and hear myself describe the problem and just providing commentary on the mind. And there is catharsis in that. But if I want a solution or I want someone to speak frankly to me, I go to someone in recovery because there's a fresh set of eyes on it. Now, obviously, it's all dependent on the options that are available to us. But if we really are struggling and we are looking for something deeper and we do want the truth, and the truth isn't always going to be comforting to hear or discover, then we need to push ourselves towards a new community often. We still have our friendships, our relationships. We can still love our friends dearly and we can still have fun with them. But the real meat and potatoes of our inner world, the stuff that would embarrass us to admit, the stuff that we deny to ourselves that drives us crazy, we need to get that out somewhere. Some do it in a confession booth.
Yeah.
But, you know, not everyone, that's not everyone's cup of tea. So we need it somewhere. But you see the point of the confession booth when you understand something's got to get said, it's got to get out there.
Yeah. There was a book that I talk about this. There's a book that by a writer talking about sin or brokenness is our only hope. And what she meant by that is like finding a place to name the stuff in us that we are embarrassed about, that we've hidden away, whether that's the confessional, which can be a hugely transforming experience, whether it's in the Catholic Church or the AA room or with your therapist. But I think, I feel like that is transformation for people. And I think lots of our religious forms, we you know, say the prayer of confession in church, but don't actually go into that space of being able to unload that stuff.
Yeah, and one of the great things about doing it is that it demystifies your problems and you can be comfortable with being flawed.
Yeah.
I mean, how many people are just walking around and they just can't admit to themselves like their main character defect?
Yeah.
That would bring a certain level of discomfort because you're living out of the truth. So I'm quite comfortable sitting here saying, I can be quite arrogant sometimes. Yeah. I can be quite an arrogant person, or I can be quite high conflict. I'm like a dog with a bone if I think that you deserve it, right? I'm going in for the kill, and that's what I'm like.
Yeah.
Also, I can be quite self-pitying. You know, sometimes I like to just marinate in the heartache, or I like to just marinate in the shame, because there's something familiar about that rather than the unexplored frontier of how you truly confront that and how you truly process it. But I can sit here with no shame and just say that. I don't really care what you think about that because I've gone on a journey of knowing that my life depends on knowing these things about myself and openly admitting them. And then it takes the power away from them because it's just like there's a freedom that comes with, I'm a dick.
What? One of my friends says we should all wear signs around our necks that like say, hi, my name's Trey. I have a problem with X. And if we actually did that, it would totally humanize like gatherings, right? And you can tell the people who are like, hell, there's no way. You could see, I was just saying that. Some people are like this, and some people are like, you know. But one of my friends was like, she's a very, very good, justice-seeking Christian. And she was like, said she was running along. We were talking about my addictions. She was running along, and she's like, she's saying, praying to God. She's contemplative run. And she was like, God, I don't really think I have any problems. What's my sin, God? And she's running along feeling like she was very middle class, and she heard God say, pride. Yeah. It's pride.
You know? One of the worst ones.
I mean, it's the root of it, you know, because you don't see it. Oh, I don't have anything. It's pride.
Yeah.
You know? So I remember when I was, so in AA, you go through on step 4 and 5, you write down all your shit, the stuff that you've done, the stuff that has happened to you that others have done. And then in step 5, it's confession. You tell it to another human being that you trust, right? You don't just go you don't tell that to the room of recovery. You don't say, get up in the pulpit and be like, guess what? I had this, you know?
Yeah.
But when I did that, it was the most scared I've ever been in my life. And it was also the most powerful spiritual experience because my sponsor heard my shit and he was like, that's rough. And I've done that too.
Yeah.
Or welcome to being human. He said, can you let that go? Welcome to being a human being.
Yeah. And that's when the faith begins to become belief because that's the moment where you go, I'm cutting off the safety harness here. I'm trusting you that if I tell you my interpretation of something that's happened, that you will not judge me and that you will find compassion and love for me. But one of the key things about the step 5 process is also, and this is what I talked about earlier, it's not just telling the story of what happened, it's allowing someone else with a different insight to give you feedback on that. Because one of the biggest revelations for me in the process of that kind of confession was finding out all the things that I wasn't responsible for. I mean, I thought everything was my fault.
Yeah.
I thought I was the center of the universe. I just thought, you know, like, I just thought all these things that happened when I was a child must have been my fault. Yes. And all of these other things that I carried with me, shame that I carried for things that happened when I didn't know any better.
Yeah.
So a really good kind of confidant is someone who doesn't just hold you accountable, but also says, this isn't your cross to bear. Get off the cross. Calm the hell down.
Yeah.
You know, you it's getting that perspective, which is not just about what you've done wrong, but about what you shouldn't be beating yourself up about.
Yeah, it's what you were saying earlier about, like, the truth that you tell about yourself is not always the truth.
Exactly.
You know, it's your version of the truth, but you sometimes embroider it in a way that makes you look like a piece of shit.
Yeah, and I think most of the things that we go into recovery with that has to be disclosed, these are things that most people will have things like that, those skeletons in their closet. Yeah. Unfortunately, one of the real ironies of being an addict and brought to your knees by that condition is that we're blessed that we get to go on that journey because our lives depend on it. Most people who don't have that, they get the benefit of not being, like, not urinating themselves or not doing nights in the cells and all the other mayhem that comes with being an addict. But some of them, they'll never be moved or propelled through that program of really trying to get to know what makes you tick, what drives you, and how to keep an eye on those instincts and moments of stress or whatever.
I think the 12 steps could be done by someone, anybody really, if they have a therapist or a friend or a priest who wants to do it. You know, you don't have to be an addict in the classical way to do it, right? You could follow those 12 steps right into 100%, transformation.
But it's kind of work that you only propelled into when you know what the alternative route is.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
As long as you're comfortable walking that middle lane, you might never be incentivized to give yourself completely to it. Yeah. And even as someone who knows they're an addict, sometimes I still need to be reminded how important it is because life gets in the way and I start thinking, oh no, God, I'll take the wheel now. Things are going really well.
Yeah.
And then you get a reminder, you know, that, you know, your life is going well because you made a commitment to that program of recovery.
Yeah. Darren McGarvin, we are out of time, but can I just say, thank you for all the ideas, but mostly thank you for trusting us with this truth and for letting us trust to you the stuff we've shared tonight. Really, really grateful. Can we give Darren McGarvey a great big hand?
Enjoy your weekend, guys.
Yeah. And if anything has come up for you tonight about shame, about trauma that you need to talk to, anyone in a red shirt can talk to you or point you to folks for on safeguarding. If, like I said, if you have any questions about recovery, you want to talk to folks, just identify yourself to someone safe, and we can help connect you to other folks too. So thanks for coming out. I'm going to turn it over to Craig.
One more time, Trey Hall and Darren McGarvey.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.